Hi, this is cinematographer Richard Rutkowski here on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hello, you globetrotting so-and-so.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
Good, good. You've just been all over the place.
It was a little bit of a whirlwind. Portland, LA, LA, Vegas, Vegas, Austin, Austin, New York, New York, Portland. So, gonna try and stay home for a little bit now.
And you were in London like 2 weeks earlier.
2 weeks before that, I was in London. But I did actually return here, so I wasn't quite counting that. But yeah, between all of that, that's a lot of travel. Plus, NAB and things are about to pop up again. So yeah, for this job, for what I'm doing here, if I want to stay up to date, if I want to stay, you know, current with everything, it sometimes requires, like, you know, boots on the ground. You kind of have to go and meet with people and talk about things and see what's happening. So that's, I'm trying to keep doing that. You know, I've been doing it for 15 years. I gotta keep doing it. So yeah.
Well, let me ask you something before we even get into this. But what is the value in going to NAB these days? Because I used to go, not every year, but I used to go somewhat frequently. And then it was like, everything that's going to get announced at NAB, I'm going to be able to see online that same day.
The short answer is that depending on who you are and what you do, there might be no value in going to NAB. And I think that a lot of people have figured that out and don't go to like big trade shows like NAB. That being said, there's extreme value in going if you live, work in that sort of equipment community. So like if you're in that equipment community and you have relationships with other people in that community, you get everyone in the same city at the same time and makes it really easy to go have face-to-face conversations. And ultimately, that's still a lot of the way people do business.
Yeah. To me, I always like to go there because like Adobe or Apple, Final Cut, Avid, whoever would be showcasing all the new stuff that their stuff did. You know, I found a camera that I used to make a film there, the Panasonic SDX900, which I found there with you. You were with me, you know, and I met Jan Crittenden, who's no longer at Panasonic, but I met her there and she actually let us use a pre-release camera to film our film. So,
Yeah, there's definitely that. Exactly what you just described. That's definitely a thing that sort of happens at NAB. People meet manufacturers. People get some sort of that early access. But there's other things that go on, too. There are OEM companies that show up essentially with a briefcase full of products, or they even have a trade show booth, and they do not want to make a product that is sold directly to an end user. They want to be the empowering sort of middleman. And sometimes that technology is available to purchase from all these other companies there, or you're able to license. There is one company that did an amazing AI microphone trickery thing, which really had me thinking like, ooh, should I go into the microphone business? Because man, it kind of blew me away when I was at the Consumer Electronics Show. I have no doubt that they'll be at NAB. If it wasn't so impressive, I would tell all of our listeners right now what it is, but I am still seriously considering maybe getting involved in this audio company because it's pretty cool. So anyway, so Ben on the show today is Richard Rutkowski. He is the DP for at least two of the episodes of Masters of the Air, the new Apple TV Plus series. Nice. And I have a great conversation with him that we'll get into in just a few minutes. But
and now, Close Focus.
Just before hitting record on this podcast, you and I were talking about the various things that are going on in the industry right now. And there's a couple of big stories. One of them, of course, is the sort of power struggle happening inside of Disney. There was a really good article that you directed me to. And then I went back and I started finding some other articles, including one that Kim Masters had contributed to about this power struggle and proxy vote battle inside of Disney. George Lucas just came out. George Lucas is now currently the largest individual shareholder of Disney stock. I think it's worth about $4.5 billion.
Wow.
And he came out saying that he fully supports and endorses the current board, and that leadership of an entertainment company shouldn't be left to amateurs. And I guess that's a direct reference to one of the activist investors who is trying to wrestle away board seat control via a proxy battle, via a vote that's going to the Disney shareholders, or try to get them to increase the number of board seats so that they can get some influence there on the board of directors. We don't know what's going to happen, because one, probably the second largest individual shareholder in Disney is this guy, Ike Perlmutter. Ike famously was fired from Disney last year. He was the head of Marvel, and he is Israeli. He had basically in his later years only sort of had overseeing and control of consumer products from Disney, which is interesting. And he, I guess, famously sort of came out and said that Disney shouldn't be investing in franchises like Black Panther or in Ms. Marvel or the Marvels or anything like that.
Because I'm noticing a pattern. I'm noticing a slight pattern in what he's against.
Exactly. He said that those toys wouldn't sell, that people wouldn't buy those toys. And I'm pretty darn sure that that's been proven very, very wrong now.
Especially with Black Panther.
Especially.
And I know the Marvels, which Ms. Marvel was a piece of, underperformed theatrically, but, you know.
But, you know, Captain Marvel, I guess he was also against. So it's like he was basically against all of those things.
So. Wait a minute. So hold the phone. He was against black people and women being superheroes.
It's you know, reading the article that was in Hollywood Reporter back in December, that's quoted in there, is that he had come out against those things. So it's not too surprising maybe that he was let go. But
And Bob Iger has been coming out and saying, you know, Bob Iger, who kind of retook control of the Walt Disney Company, has been saying that there's going to be a little bit less of a social conscience governing the content that they make. So in other words, he doesn't want to offend anyone is really what it comes down to, which is very different from he doesn't want to have a black or a woman superhero. It's more like Strange World, which had a major gay character. And I don't really think it was done in any kind of in your face offensive way. But I think that we're going to see more progressive politics dialed back a little bit in Disney movies. And I'm not here to say whether it's right or wrong, but I also know that Bob Iger's an old man and he knows how to make money with the Disney brand. I found it very interesting. One of the reasons it came to my attention that this is all happening is on another podcast that I listen to, The Town, which I talk about all the time on here. Somebody has been advertising on there telling Disney shareholders how to vote. And I was like, what? But I think they know that stuff like The Town has kind of become sort of one of the trades. You know, it hasn't replaced the trades, but I feel like, you know, you could take out a full page ad in Variety, or you could take out an ad on The Town and try and influence the vote.
There's definitely been some linking too of Perlmutter to Trump, which is interesting, which is also in that article. He, I guess, went and attended a Trump event at some sort of thing. So there's been some discussion that if Perlmutter or his proxies or the people he's working with get seats on the board, that would be like giving Trump direct access to the board of Disney. So
yeah,
I know that's a whole thing. So
I say let's keep politics entirely out of this. But yeah, okay,
yeah, you know there's a whole reason that presidents are supposed to be divested of, you know, corporate interests. So anyway, so Ben, that was not the only thing though that we discussed, and this other thing I thought was compelling enough for us to get into. There was a group of about 50 people who got together and used AI to make a parody remake of Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Yeah, yeah. And you can find the trailer. We can actually link to it in the show notes, but you can see the trailer and it looks very AI.
It looks very AI. And it's interesting. There's an IndieWire article, which we can also link to, that basically the filmmakers know that it's bad. It is a bad parody. It's not, you know, it's not a good movie. But they say it's got like a time capsule. It's to show what the state of the art is with AI right now. And they got these people from all over the world to take on different scenes from Terminator 2 and put it all together. And it's sort of done jokingly and lovingly. But I got to say that just from watching the one extended scene and the trailer, other than the sort of like whiz bang that maybe a movie like, you know, maybe Final Fantasy would have had in an animated film that came out years ago, like, ooh, whiz bang, look at that.
Yeah.
It really leaves you feeling flat. There is nothing. It is not. It's not good. It's not. Yeah. It's not entertaining.
I support them, obviously, because I'm a big fan of messing around with AI to do whatever. I support them in doing it. And I think it's cool that they made sort of a time capsule of what it would look like to make an AI feature today. But the argument that I consistently have with anyone who says, like, we're going to just make full movies in AI. I'm like, I think you're going to make background plates, maybe drone shots. AI will have its place, but I feel like this is writ large how the human element, nothing can act like an actor. And AI is entirely pulling from other sources. It's not making anything original. I'll be impressed when AI can make a movie like Sophie's Choice and, you know, can actually make you cry. Like, I'll be impressed when I can feel emotionally moved. And I guess that's the thing, is I look at it and it's like, yeah, the visuals are impressive. I feel like it emulates the way the camera would look at the image and a lot of stuff like that. But it doesn't in any way replace actors. But I applaud the filmmakers for saying, like, hey, let's see how far we can take it. I don't know that I would have gone as far as a feature, but I do think that it was maybe smart of them to choose something that not only already existed, but was really well known. Like, I even think people today still watch T2. You know, T2 is a movie that hasn't really gone out of style. And I think it's interesting that they would do T2, by the way, because I remember going, I hope I haven't told this story 600 times on this podcast, but I remember going to see T2 with a makeup artist friend of mine. I was doing special effects makeup back then. I mean, like, I was barely out of high school, but that was sort of the trajectory I was on. And we saw T2 and he was like, well, I guess that's it for us. Makeup won't exist anymore. And not only does makeup exist just fine today, but I feel like we look at it and we go, there are certain things makeup does better than CGI, more efficiently, more inexpensively, more convincingly, yada, yada. And I think that we're going to see the same thing with CGI. And I think the one thing CGI is going to have the hardest time doing is recreating real human emotions. That to me is Waterloo for AI, it, currently now anyway. You know, we've all seen Sora. Sora looks amazing, but I don't look at it and feel anything, you know?
I agree 100%. And I got to say, after this trip, when I was in Austin, I was at South By, and I got to attend a panel discussion about multinodal AI in particular. And I have to admit, I was not familiar with the term multinodal AI before I sat in that room.
I mean, it's just AI with multiple nodes. What's not to understand? Go on.
Multinodal AI, for everyone else out there who was like me and didn't know this term.
I'm personally quite sick of mononodal AI.
Well, mononodal AI is what you've been using if you've used ChatGPT or anything, including Sora. That is all a mononodal. Multinodal is AI that understands the individual objects that are inside the images. It understands the context of the words. It understands more than anything that you've used right now, which is really what needs to be developed in order to have those scenarios that we've discussed on the show before, including some famous filmmakers who have said, oh, one day you're going to be able to go home and say, I want to star in a movie with Marilyn Monroe and this, the AI will generate it. Well, the reality of that is that is decades and decades and decades away, because there are so many things that need to go into it, including just the energy consumption. I mean, there's so much.
Also,
so
I just want to say, yeah, it will suck. It won't be any good.
So when you read that Elon Musk says, oh, the singularity is happening in 2029 and that there will be an AI that is smarter than all humans, really, we're still talking about the same parlor trick. We're talking about the parlor trick right now of a system that has been invented to do one thing very well and very difficult for it to have true reasoning or understanding emotions, understanding all the things that would make entertainment compelling. Understand, like, you're going to end up having an experience exactly like watching the Terminator 2 remake or plenty of other things where you don't have any connection with if you're relying on a computer to create all the stuff. And that includes the audio, that includes understanding what is the foreground object from a background object, how those two things interact, what is the physicality of those things. It's a very good parlor trick right now to have a cool looking image or to have a
parlor trick is a perfect way to describe all of it, in my opinion.
Yeah, or a semi-competent paragraph or multiple paragraphs. And there's the reason, too, that you need to have more and more human interaction the longer any of these things get, which is why, exactly as you've described, maybe it'll be used for, to fake a drone shot. Maybe it'll be used for a VFX. AI has been used, machine learning has been used in VFX for a very long time, but most of the companies who are using it weren't advertising it because they want to maintain their competitive advantage. So it's not like people are, this is particularly new, it's just now never been more publicized. What's really interesting to me though is how many people out there are looking at AI generated images, because this is sort of skewed into social media in a way now that there are bot accounts or accounts that people are just trying to get traffic, where they're putting up relatively poor, I would say, AI-generated images and just using popular hashtags and trying to direct eyeballs for one reason or another. And the amount of real people who like and pay attention to that and say, and I guess don't see that there is anything that is askew from reality, is surprising. So this is a little bit of a tangent from, talking about AI and our AI, where we're going to see AI immediately is, I'm going to say, people who are looking to either direct your attention or possibly scam people. There's a whole article now that's come out about people using AI images of animals in peril to get eyeballs. Like, oh, you like animals? Here's an animal in peril. Click on this link type of thing.
Gross.
So really, all of the things that you think of that AI could be used for bad, sure, they're going to happen. But the things that people are thinking of using it for good is if, appropriate, entertainment or really, really high quality entertainment, the stuff that we're involved in on a daily basis, like television and movies, that is so far away. That is possibly not in the lifetimes of anyone who is living right now, that it really isn't going to be the major impact that I think that some people really believe it is, including studios and including guilds. But I will tell you, it will have an impact, just not the impact I think people are thinking of, and not in the way that people are not going to disengage and suddenly decide they want to go watch, T2 remakes all the time. That's not going to happen. People will still want to have
an original story that's all told in AI.
Correct.
You know, so, the thing that I talked about last week, those two guys in Eastern Europe who are making, movies using models and stuff like that. Like, to me, that's infinitely more charming. And AI in all of these workflows, I don't think it's escapable, because it can do a lot of repetitive bullshit that we would have to do. I mean, look no further than, Michael Cioni's new venture Strata, where they're using AI to transcribe into multiple languages and to sync up multiple sources and arrange everything and to do it all in the cloud and to do it so that it's instantly available for everybody to view. And like, what he's using AI to do is to do the uncreative stuff. That's what it's best at. And I do often wonder, why are we focusing on making movies with AI and not, curing cancer or something? I mean, it seems like that would be
I think there is some of that. People are looking at global warming. People are looking at different things to try to use AI, the human genome. I think that it's happening as well. But our little corner of the world, this is what we do, Monday through Friday. So this is, I think, why it comes to full attention in the trades and in conversations and, podcasts just like this.
Well, cool. Let's get to our interview here.
Let's do it. Here is Richard Rutkowski.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by cinematographer Richard Rutkowski. Hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You first came into my awareness on a little show called The Americans. I love The Americans. For my money at that time, it was the best show on television. I thought that your work, the work that you did on that show, had a lot to do with it. So I am a huge fan from way back. I was very pleased to see that you did a couple episodes of this new Apple TV series called Masters of the Air. And we're going to dive into that in just a moment. But I want to go back. I looked at your IMDb bio. It says you're from Oklahoma. How does a guy from Oklahoma run off and join the circus? How do you come to being a cinematographer? What's your journey like?
Well, I was born in Oklahoma because my mother's parents lived in Oklahoma City. They had been Pentecostal missionaries. So as a young person, I had a lot of experience with revivals and church service. And I would say that was a great introduction to show business. And I didn't live full-time ever in Oklahoma City. We would visit my mother's parents, and she wanted to be there for the birth of her eldest. But we lived across the nation following the career of my father. My late father, Kazimir Rutkowski, was a painter, an oil on canvas, landscape, still life portrait painter. And we lived in New York City when I was quite young, and also in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and then for a long stretch in Fort Smith, Arkansas, right on the Oklahoma border. And then we moved to the Hamptons. So I moved to the Hamptons when I was about 11 years old, lost my Southern accent, and spent most of my, you know, middle and high school years in the Hamptons, and then moved on to college. So I'm mostly an East Coaster. I'm by far more related to the East Coast than the South, although I can still do the Southern accent if it comes up.
Well, that is a very diverse group of places that you grew up in, that you lived and you traveled through. Okay, so you became an East Coaster. When did you realize that cinematography was the thing that you could do as a career?
I don't think it really sunk in until I was finishing college. And during college, I was making 16 millimeter short films and really making them, doing every part of it, hauling the gear to sets on the weekends, returning the gear on Mondays, staying up late at the Steenbeck editing, working with optical printers, an Oxbury animation stand, electronic music. I would then go dub my own mag tracks on 16 and synchronize the mag track to the picture. And these were very formative and very, very tangible experiences with the medium that I really grew to love. Prior to that, I thought I'd be an engineer or maybe an architect. I had a bent towards the mechanical and also the scientific. And I thought, well, I'll go to college and I'll come out of it with some technical training or some other job-based knowledge. And then it all went another way. I wound up working with a man named Robert Wilson in the theater. And Robert Wilson is well known as the creator of Einstein and the Beach and Civil Wars and The Black Rider. And Bob's work is legendary in theater. And it was a real crash course in show business, but also the arts. And even though I had an artist father, I hadn't really been exposed to the performing arts that much, certainly not on a high level. Once I got exposed to Bob's work ethic, and it's tremendous, I became a person who just lived on film sets. I got into film right after college, joined the union, started loading film, then doing the clapper, then focus pulling, then eventually shooting. All through it, though, I was doing creative projects. I was shooting short films for myself or other people.
Wow. I think that that's very much the traditional path that a lot of people took. They started in the camera department and worked their way up. Although I hear less and less people starting out these days having that sort of discipline. Do you feel that learning all of those different crafts helps make you a better DP today?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. And I left out that my first job on a film was in locations, literally putting up signs, putting up curtains so that people could have dressing rooms, moving us in and out of locations and cleaning up after the team. And in that capacity, I learned a lot by seeing what every department was up to and inserting myself at just the right moment to get a little, you know, better access to the camera. The man shooting that film was Elliot Davis, who's brilliant. And I learned a lot just watching him, talking to him after. I knew at the end of that project, and I had still had to go back and finish college, that I was probably onto a camera trajectory. And I think that really what's lost right now is not per se that some people come out and just say, I'm a cinematographer, and they're quite young, and sure, you can get an image on the monitor. It's more that the discipline of shooting film is very important, I think, and needs to be thought about and observed, because the more you go higher and higher into categories of projects that are very complicated, you suddenly realize that the basic training at the film camera, where everything has to be in a certain order and done just right, and the technical achievement is invisible, we don't have a good monitor, we're essentially exposing celluloid with only a few people on the set understanding how that's going to eventually turn out. That is a very important part of the technique that should be considered. And I hope by people who are serious about making films followed. I think it's super important to learn about exposing film.
I agree wholeheartedly. And my experience actually mimics this so much too. I started as a loader and I worked in film, and that was basically the trajectory of my career for a very long time. And I just kind of want to do a quick shout out to some of your camera assistant credits because you worked on some incredible movies from the early and mid 90s, very much in the time that I was coming up. School Ties, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, Kids, Dead Presidents, Flirting with Disaster. Brilliant movie. Copland, Fallen, Julian Donkey Boy. I mean, Requiem for a Dream. Actually, you're a camera operator on Requiem for a Dream. But
yeah,
I mean,
I also shot all those very macro takes. That took several days. We couldn't duplicate the negative the way we would digitally now. So every time that there's a quick close cutaway of sip of coffee or exhalation of smoke or sniff of a line, it was an individual piece of film all shot in a big black tent.
And I got to imagine that certainly having this trajectory where, you know, your projects, they just sort of like build one on top of the other, better and better. And when you don't necessarily have all of the crushing weight of responsibility as for, you know, being the overall architect of the look of a project, you get to absorb and learn from so many great other people who are doing this work. Can you talk a little bit about just, you know, maybe being in that right place and what it is that you get to absorb and take from that?
Well, you've stated it exactly right. I think that the important thing to remember is you are focused on that job you're doing. So whether it's being the second and marking and putting T marks down and pulling them up, managing the camera and the delivery of everything to and from the set, which is what I did on the movie School Ties, you are looking at the whole thing and it can be quite intimidating. Oh my gosh. But you have your job and your job is very specific. And you try to work your way into that job category and do the absolute best you can while keeping your ears open. So I've really benefited from some opportunities to work with extraordinary cameramen. I've also benefited from the idea that I remembered what they had to say. Mm. And sometimes they aren't speaking directly to you, but they're often saying something that really lingers with you as you then become a cameraman or you think back on those experiences. You mentioned Dead Presidents. I was only on for a week. That was free. The focus puller on that was Alec Baim, and he was working for Lisa Rinsler, who I then pulled focus for in Vietnam later.
And three seasons. Yeah, that's right. An incredibly beautiful movie. It's
very beautiful movie. I was very proud to work on it. And then the movie Fallen, I was just there a couple days, but those couple days involved an absolute disaster for the transpo department. Trucks stuck on a muddy way in and out of a remote cabin in the woods. It didn't go very well for the transpo department, and I've never forgotten it. I remember this lesson now every job. The point is, you're focused on the job you do, and I took it very seriously. I would literally create index cards with different parts of the job category. I think I had a moniker in my head when I was seconding that went meter, monitor, marks, film, circle, slate, power and cables insured. Actually, it was fast pace. It was focus, flare, frame, flicker, filter, flexion, film, aperture, apple box, shutter speed, table, tack, tap, powers and cables insured. And I figured if I went through that list every time we had a new setup, I'd accomplish what had to work correctly to get the project through that shot and the next and the end of the day. So even the word film has multiple resonances. You're thinking about how much film you've exposed, how much you have left on the truck, what are the magazines loaded with, is there an emergency mag loaded with the higher speed film stock just in case, and then what's your plan for the next day? Don't leave the magazines empty at the end of a day if you know what tomorrow's work is. So these are the details that factored into that job category, and I've remembered that discipline all the way up to doing large shows. To speak about the cameraman that I was exposed to, on School Ties, the cameraman was Freddie Francis. Mm. And Freddie was a legend from England. There was a moment while we were working, and I hadn't realized I was on probation. I had been hired as a sort of somewhat thin resumé second onto a major Paramount film. But there was no intention to keep me if I didn't work out, if there wasn't absolute clarity from the DP through camera operator to the assistants that I was working hard and doing my job. So I didn't know it, but I was on this probation period. End of the second week, Freddie Francis calls me over. Boy, because he always called me boy. Boy, come here, boy. I want to talk to you. I'm like, oh, Freddie, what do you need? He goes, boy, you'll do all right. You'll be okay. You can stay on. And I hadn't even realized up to that point that was in
probationary. You thought you had the job.
And I said, thank you, Freddie. You know, I'm processing all this. And well, that's great. And he goes, but boy, there's a few things I can teach you. So you have to imagine my heart leaps into my throat. You know, two-time Oscar winner, ultimate filmmaker of the 20th century, Freddie Francis has something to teach me. So I said, yes, Freddie, what is that? He goes, boy, if you stand behind the lamp, then you know you're not in it. Now, I'd watched him shoo people out of his lights for 2 weeks now. He lit hard. He lit with hard units, and he lit old-fashioned black and white style. A key would be a 5K. A fill would be a 2K direct on the performer. He would use the Varicon, a bathe of light across the front of the element of the lens, to reduce contrast, having an incredibly contrasty lighting style. But he would be sitting there trying to take readings and balance all these lights, and someone inevitably would walk in front of one lamp, and he'd turn, and he'd go, who is that? Who is that? So stand behind the lamp, you know you're not in it. And he goes, boy, if you know the lens and where it's pointed, you might stay out of that as well. And this was because every setup, often an AD or someone from the production department would manage to be in the frame, even though there are video taps and we've announced very clearly it's the 35 millimeter here on a track, stay out of the lens. It was just about moving the project forward at the most efficient rate while getting the artistry he wanted in. And then I'm about to leave and he goes, oh, and one other thing. If you listen to the important people speaking, you'll know when to shut up.
Those are some kernels of wisdom that sounds simplistic, but holy crap, you're absolutely right, because you know people get onto set and then they almost, you know, I think they forget their place sometimes, and that things are trying to go along and people talk and stand in the wrong place. And so yeah, it, you know, Freddie Francis is really right. If you stay out of the shot, stay out of the light, and shut up, you're probably doing pretty well. You're probably doing a lot of the right things.
Well, it's simply that every day on every set, I've watched those errors occur, even to the point where you're down to 100 millimeters. So you're doing quite a close shot and someone with a headset finds it. And it's usually for the simple reason that the real estate of a film set gets crowded. All the departments bring themselves in, carts start approaching, boom operators, dressers, prop persons, they all invade. And there's one spot that's open. And it's where the scene is. And so people think, oh, I'll just stand over here. So I, you know, in any case, that was a first fundamental lesson. After Freddie, I wrote a letter to Ed Lockman.
Oh, yes.
And Ed was at that time younger than I am now, which is kind of intimidating, but he was, you know, a working cameraman with really great credits. Ed saw my letter, a slim resume, but on it was Albert Maisels. I had assisted as a second the Maisels up in Boston. So Ed calls me. This is pre-internet, pre-even pager, really. And he calls me and says, come on over to the loft. And then I wound up working for Ed for years in New York, which was a huge introduction to the group of filmmakers who I then could have access to. That's how I met the Gus Van Sant folks and wound up working with Larry Clark and Harmony on Kids. And then, you know, Harmony and I had a arc of that for a while. And then you know, Eric Edwards showed up because of that. And Eric was shooting Even Cowgirls. And then he asked me if I'd do Kids with him, which was a crazy story about how Kids was getting started and whether the union wanted to cover it or not. And they were very scared of it. And I did the job and really enjoyed it. Lots of things happened. So it is that kind of interlocking chain, next to next to next. Oddly enough, my association with Maddie Libatique, I did a show in LA as a focus puller. Maddie was at AFI. He heard about me through the production office, got in touch with me. I said, of course, come on in. He said, I'll do anything in the camera department. Can I be a PA? And I said, you should, yes. And then I saw he was talented and serious. And I said, you know, you should talk to Ed Lockman. He comes out here. He has a place in LA and he often brings his gear and I can't always be there. So he needs help. So then Maddie and I were both essentially the shepherds of 50 cases of Ed Lockman equipment for all these jobs. And then Maddie gets out of AFI. He and Darren do Pie in the City. And I think I loaned them something out of my loft. I forget what. And the next thing I knew, he hires me as the operator on Requiem. And then because of Requiem, that's how I met Adrian Lyne and Peter Bijou for the movie Unfaithful. So it's all those interlocking chains. with the consistency being, I really paid close attention to what I heard each cameraman saying. And it wasn't always just what they did, because many people can bring in a four by four frame and a lamp behind it of various strength and then balance that light a certain way. It's what they said about the philosophy of it that I found really fascinating. And I like to think that I bring a philosophical or at least a sort of architectural perspective to how a show receives its visual vocabulary right from the beginning.
I'd like to get into that philosophy a little bit, and maybe we could also talk about that philosophy as it relates to the Americans, because, you know, I think that that may be, looking at your filmography, the show that you've done the most episodes of, I think is 38. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the Americans and how you brought that philosophy to bear.
Well, the Americans was an interesting situation. I had done a show for the FX network called Lights Out, and it only had one season. And it wasn't a large budget show, but it was a kind of fascinating concept. And I thought we realized it pretty well. So I had an in with FX. Along comes 2 years later, a potential to do another FX show called The Americans, two relatively unknown writers. The showrunner director was a guy named Adam Arkin, Alan Arkin's son, but really Adam himself, a very talented and established actor. And he'd been directing on FX projects, Sons of Anarchy and things like that. And we had a sit down talk in an office, lower Manhattan, and connected. And I thought Adam was super nice and open and interesting. And I discussed with him the notion of how to make not the nicest people and not the most beautiful period in not the most beautiful places attractive. Because these people are murderers. They are the enemy. Yeah. They are spies, and they're going to murder, and they're going to fool people and extort and blackmail people. They are lying to their children full time and trying to create this false life that the children are leading that gives them the power to do their work. And early 1980s in suburban DC is not the most beautiful period you can imagine. We're not on the left bank in the 40s or anything. So I started looking at still photography, and I started looking at a lot of the still photography like Stephen Shore, different guys who had gone into the American landscape in the late 60s, early 70s, and started picturing what was there. Not an idealized thing, not so much the Avedon treatment, but really what was right in front of you. There was a book called American Prospects. So that was a foundation. And we talked about draining color, pulling back on color. We talked about a kind of DC proper, like the proper establishment DC with its bolder primaries and a kind of red, white, and blue cleanliness. And then their life, which lives in between. And then the lives they delve into when they're ruining people's lives to get ahead as spies. And that was going to be more degenerated and grainy. And we were working with the Alexa Classic, the first Alexa camera. And what I liked about it was I could pump the ASA a little and get some grain into the image. I also could apply a LUT in pre-production and work between, I think we wound up with 12 in the end, of which I was only using 3 or 4. But these LUTs would help define the image right away, right on camera, right in the eyepiece, right on the monitor. And then it was the work with the cast. And this was, I think, the thing I learned the most doing that many episodes of The Americans. I was the only cameraman up through season 3. And then we started doing a little bit of alternating. But for 2 and more seasons, I did every show and I had people scouting for me. And then I'd show up on set, having read the scout notes, having seen the images, and react to what we needed to do to get the scenes shot. The process of working with the cast, and I mean all of them, not just the leads, Carrie and Matt, who are fantastic, but Noah Emmerich and Richard Thomas, it's too many to mention. And especially the Russians, the people playing the Russians who spoke Russian so well that in Russia, apparently they don't subtitle. They don't have to subtitle the Russian language when the Americans showed in Russia. I do understand they changed the title to The Assholes, but that's it. So, in any case.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, little known, little. Yeah. In any case, working with that cast created in me the reality, which is that they face 5 or 7 different directors in a season. Mm. I'm at the camera all the time. And so an unspoken connection is being made about whether a scene is moving well, whether a take is truly finished. I learned to stop reaching for that cut button, no matter who said what. If the actor was in it, we don't cut. You leave the, please leave the boom up. These keep out of the frame. If the actor's in it, we're not cutting. We'll go till they're ready. And I also learned to choreograph with actors with far more agility than I had known before. I'd always known about blocking, and I'd watched lots of films, and I'd marked the screen with a crosshair and analyzed how Chris Menges or Deakins would move people to and fro the lens to achieve the various choreographies of shot. I learned it far more in the tactile world of doing it over and over and over again, thousands of setups over 3 seasons. So yeah. That was a very big and instructive part. They were also beautifully written scripts. There was always something of a backbone of an intellectual process where we compared their family and really the conflicts within a family to world families and conflicts within world families. Russians and Americans aren't so different. They have different ideologies, and like each other, they want to be dominant. But what does that mean when you start competing with each other in such a, you know, people's lives are ruined by such competition? We had parts of the show dealt with Iran-Contra or Central America. Parts of the show dealt with the Black Power movement in ways that I thought were really compelling and good writing and good philosophy for shows.
Yeah, I agree. Certainly the leads are some incredible antiheroes that, you know, you understand their motivation. You understand, even if you don't agree with their actions, you understand their motivation and what they're doing all the way through it. And I want to say that the work that you do lends empathy. It lends empathy for the viewer to, you know, to better understand what's going on. How many times would you say that you read a scene that you're shooting? Like, if you think about from the beginning of the time you got the script to the time that you actually wrap that scene, how many times do you think you've read it?
Probably 60.
Yeah.
Between the first reads and then the discussions and then the returns to locations with your keys and then tech scouting. And then even this morning I was at a church with my director, Julianne Robinson, to discuss how we would stage that work. And she has very clear ideas on how to get the blocking to work out. And we're going to have to fight the fact that we can't always see all the people filling the church. So easily 60 times. The best is when it's handed to you on the sides and you've got all that in you, and then you can flip the page over and start drawing out, okay, this, two cameras like this. And it just comes easier if you've done that homework.
We got to talk about Masters of the Air. I think that when you mentioned logistics, you mentioned like the Herculean task of like having to make certain types of movies or projects move forward. I know it might be a little bit different on a television series like that, where you come in and you work a couple of episodes, but that is a big, huge scope project where I know, you know, costume and art had been working a year before, you know, cameras ever rolled. Can you talk a little bit about the logistics of Masters of the Air and you coming into this project? I know you came in for some later episodes, but talk about having a machine like that moving and then getting plugged into the insanity.
Well, it would be wrong to say insanity.
Okay, fine.
It was really well organized. We had one of the legendary producers of our time, Gary Getzman, on site, and he was backed up by the team at Amblin. These folks know what they're doing and they know how to plan ahead. So it wasn't coming into insanity. It was coming into a grand scope. I had the benefit that I was the third block. I wasn't the first or second. A lot of issues that had been confronted by the first and second blocks had resulted in changes that made the workflow a little bit better and a little bit more reasonable, or at least predictable. And I don't want to make it sound like I wasn't nervous at times. Sure, when you're going to call 250 people into a cold field to shoot an enormous establisher and then go into coverage, and you know you have to like get it done within a certain amount of time, and you're working with searchlights and you're trying not to overlight or make it too plain. Yeah, you get nervous. But at the same time, I had such a great team around me and I had such a great road prepared for me that it was really one of the more enjoyable experiences. The one thing I would say also is I really am attracted to stories that have authenticity in them. And this group, the Band of Brothers, the Pacific, and now this, their hallmark is that they put the authentic on camera. It is all exactly what it's meant to be, what it was at the time, as close as they can get. And I think that people watching this show are seeing these interiors of the aircraft and they're realizing, my gosh, these things were just like contraptions to die in. And yet they went up over and over again, all to drop some bombs each time. The bomber stops being a tool for war after it drops its bomb. It's just a target.
Yeah, it's harrowing, the show. There's moments in the show where you realize how primitive all of the technology for waging war and protecting these people was at the time. And I want to bring it around, though, too, because, you know, the process of actually making all that happen involves all of these different sorts of physical effects. You've got, the makeup effects. You've got the gags for the actual, destruction of the aircraft when it's hit by flak and things like this. And I know from some of the behind the scenes that you were using either some sort of rear projection or virtual stage sort of situation and a gimbal. And can you talk a little bit about that process of actually, making the combat and all of this choreography of all these different, aspects come together?
Well, a lot of that had been prepared by Adam and his director, Kerry, during the first block. And it had been schemed and designed before anyone really, showed up to film in it. And it was on a scale beyond any I'd worked on. Now, I'd worked on large sets with blue screens, and I'd worked on smaller sets with LCD walls, but I'd never worked on an LCD wall set like this. I mean, the thing could have almost enclosed a couple tennis courts.
Wow.
And it was an enormous U-shape, like almost a horseshoe-shape wall, quite tall, and a ceiling. And into that wall and ceiling, they were able to play content in real time that the performers could interact with. And beyond that, the performers, if they're in the nose cone of the aircraft or other sections, could be on a gimbal-controlled articulated steel deck that would shake when flak was supposedly hitting, or it would tilt when they were diving, or it would bank when they were banking. This gave you the opportunity for the players inside the actors inside the cockpits to feel that motion and react to it very naturally. And then the gimbal system was tracking with the video system. And then our cameras had GPS locators on them, like a sort of micro locationing device that allowed the background to respond to where the camera is so that it knew how much background to put on and all that. The whole thing is very complicated, but in its parts, you're kind of back to very basics of filmmaking. You need a background that's realistic. You need a background that has some relationship to what the performers are doing. And you need the light on the performer's face to reflect the environment. Well, the great thing about such an enormous volume is that you could accentuate, you could actually turn up brightness on one side or turn down brightness on another, or move a piece of dark material across the roof of the, the ceiling of the LCD wall. And that would give you these interactive effects on the faces. And outside the aircraft, the windscreens and the curved nose cones and the top gunner with his curved plexiglass openings would respond to reflections of what they were seeing very naturally. So it solved many problems that would have otherwise been solved down the line in VFX. Not all of it survived. A lot of it got replaced by VFX for various reasons. As much as you could sell a believable horizon and skyline and set of cloud formations in the background, it was very hard to sell enemy aircraft moving in close proximity or the other B-17s in the background being realistic enough to see. But they did it, and it took them years, and they worked very hard. And they had set up for us a very good system to work that way. I tried as much as I could, and I like computers. I don't enjoy the internet, but I like computers, and I like what computers can do in and of themselves and serve in terms of solving problems in real time. So I was having a great deal of fun with it all, actually. Having had some experience in smaller aircraft, flying single engine aircraft and doing maneuvers and tight things over and landing in wind and all that sort of stuff, I sort of had a feeling for what things should feel and look like. And thus I enjoyed that part of it a lot.
I know that the episodes that you shot, 7 and 8, were directed by Dee Reese. You did second unit on Mudbound, years ago with Dee. So
the airplane parts.
Oh, really?
That's exactly how this all came about. We went out to an airfield in Long Island, and we shot interiors of vintage aircraft with our actors with a big blue screen outside and a light on an arm and things like that. So I remember very well preparing and shooting that work with Dee, who's a genius and a sweetheart person, a very intelligent, wise, excellent director. And so when she called and said, can you make this work? I was like, I'll be there. Yeah, she asked me to join her, and I'm eternally grateful.
Mudbound was such a great project too, and I'm really glad that you guys get to continue your collaboration and working together like this. And thinking about Masters of the Air, you've got a lot of POW sequences as well too.
Yes.
It's not just all airplanes and cockpit. And I want to say that the POW, you know, these prison camps, the POW camp sequences definitely feels, you know, a grittier, more stripped down version from, you know, the Allied forces in England. Can you talk a little bit about creating the different looks for the different places, you know, the different locales in the show?
Well, I'm glad you brought all that up because it is a very different pair of episodes in terms of locations. And we established the POW camp look, and then we established the look of the Ramatelli Air Base where the red tail Tuskegee Airmen fly out of. And these locations really had to look quite different than earlier work on the show. I mean, I'm beholden to making sure that the work on the show set at Thorpe Abbotts reflects previous work at Thorpe Abbotts. But here I had to go off in a very different direction so that when you cut to a sequence, you know 100%, oh yeah, we're back with them at the POW camp. So I did testing and LUT creation, and we worked with different, you know, theories of the lighting. We were much aided in the POW camp by the fact that one of the Red Tails, Alexander Jefferson, had hand-drawn interiors of his experience there. He'd been a POW there, and he had made many drawings. And in fact, some of those drawings gave us our place to put the lens. We literally put it where he saw it. And it also aided Dee in understanding all the details and the design work. And the thing you have to realize is, even though they were being treated fairly well compared to a common infantryman, I mean, the Luftwaffe was running these camps, so they were more respectful to their fellow airmen. It was a grim place. It was a grim, underfed, tedious, depressing existence. The light bulbs that were given to the POW camps were always the dimmest ones. Lights went out at certain hours and it was in the darkness. We really try to emphasize at the end of eight just how dark it was when you turn the lights out. It was muddy. It was stained with the sort of too many men all together smoking, you know, having this sort of unwashed life together. And we really wanted to get that across. And we were once again assisted in every way by hair, makeup, and wardrobe, Colleen Atwood's work, Chris Seeger's work. We didn't, in the end, pull a roof off of the POW barracks. We stayed within the confines of the low ceiling, which led to some creative, you know, where to put lamps. We also didn't want it to be too high key. Like if you think of an old Hogan's Heroes episode or The Great Escape, you know, there's just too much light there. It's just too crystal clear to see. And that wasn't the existence these men were going through. And so we tried to show that accurately. By far, the brightest light source in a POW camp is the searchlight. Nothing should be brighter than the searchlight. So,
Richard, this is a great conversation. I so enjoyed having you break down your career and Masters of the Air. I think this is a really good place to leave it. Is there a place online? A lot of DPs don't have it, but is there a place online? Do you do a social media or something? Is there a place that people can find you or find your work outside of the streaming services and all of the different places you can get a movie these days?
I'm on Instagram, and the handle is at Richard Rutkowski DP. There's also a website that I encourage people to look at because it shows more of the art projects and the things I've done in the past for Robert Wilson or for Harmony Korine, and that's seenoevil.net. I think you can also go to richardrutkowski.com, honestly. I think I finally got that domain, but seenoevil has a dash, so it's like seenoevil. .net. And there's some projects that I'm really quite proud of that don't fit the, they don't necessarily say, hire this guy for television. They're a little different. So,
Richard Rutkowski, thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you.
All right. So that was Richard Rutkowski. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was great talking to you. And I'm looking forward to having you on again sometime in the future.
All right. Well, yeah, come back on when you have when you've got a new project.
Ben, guess what time it is?
What time is it?
Well, it is mid-morning now, but I got to tell you, it's also bill paying time. We got to pay some bills. So we got to thank the fine people over at Aputure. Aputure, maker of all kinds of fancy lights and accessories. And boy, they have new lights that are elevating their brand to even bigger and better sets all over the world now. But one of the things I want to talk about is something that I think gets overlooked quite a bit, which is an accessory they make called the Spotlight Max. The Spotlight Max is a Bowens mount projection lens for high output LEDs. So I would say any sort of light that's probably 600 watts or more, that's got a Bowens mount, you can put the Spotlight Max on it. And this is particularly effective if you're working with reflectors. A lot of, you know, sort of a trick of the trade these days is to put a light into a reflector and use that reflector possibly into other reflectors all around the set. So to get what seems like multiple light sources from a single high powered light. You can add gobos, you can do different things, but it's a very, very high quality optic. And they've really made something that's pretty special. It's razor sharp. It does have compatibility with ETC projection lenses, which that is the source for. That is sort of like the industry standard out there is the ETC. So you can swap different lenses into that. Previously, you could only do that with like an HMI light engine. So now you can take advantage of the ETC lenses on LED technology. It's a super cool trick. And of course, you can find these over at Hot Rod Cameras. Hot Rod Cameras is stocking these. We have them for order. So if you are looking for a projection lens for your Bowens mount, maybe like a 1200 or a 600, hit us up and my team can tell you all about it and get you a fancy new projection lens.
And now, Short Ends.
All right. So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's where we talk about our obsessions of the week. What are you about this week?
Well, I know I've brought these guys up several times, but...
Then why are you bringing them up again?
Well, because it's a different story.
Corridor is a different obsession?
No. Corridor Digital, and I look forward to their Saturday show, which is usually VFX artists react, although sometimes it's stunt men or women react or animators react. They did a thing that if you do a little bit of a deep dive, you'll find this all over the place. So in Barbie, behind the scenes... They were so hot and bothered to make Barbie look like it was all done practically that in the behind the scenes footage, they keyed out the blue screen and put fake backgrounds into the behind the scenes.
Wow.
And it was kind of like a shocking thing. And the Corridor guys, as they often do, kind of went down a rabbit hole of like, this isn't new. They pointed out on Mission Impossible 3, there's a behind the scenes shot of the Tom Cruise, the famous stunt from that movie where the bomb goes off on the bridge and throws him into the car. And so obviously they didn't drop a bomb on the bridge to throw Tom Cruise into the car. It was a wire stunt. But they, in the behind the scenes, they comped that into the monitor. So it looked like when everyone was cheering for it, they were cheering for the explosion. And I just think it's very interesting that there's kind of a fetishization of practical effects. We did it all practically. And it's like, I hate to say it. Do you know off the top of your head how many VFX shots there are in the original Jurassic Park 1993?
I want to say it's like 45 or something like that.
I think it's more like 78.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's not that many. And yeah. I think that if you were to watch the average episode of anything, there's cleanup, there's, you know, makeup fix, you know, an actor might have had a zit and they had to paint it out, or there was a logo that legal couldn't clear or whatever it was, and everything's being painted out and moved around and stuff like that. And I just thought it was very interesting that, you know, and I mean, no disrespect to Barbie, as I have said on the show many times, I think it looks great. I think everyone did a great job on it. Kudos to everyone. I just thought it was weird, a weird choice in the behind the scenes video, because if you're like you and me, or even like you and me age, you know, 16, when you would see like a behind the scenes on a movie come up, you want to find out how they did it. That's the whole point. And so it's super weird that they would obfuscate the way they did it. It's just odd.
It's interesting. I saw a thing online. It was all about the PR for Top Gun Maverick and telling everyone like all the plane stuff was real. All the plane stuff was real. All the plane stuff was real. Well, there are thousands of fake, and by fake, I mean CG planes in that movie. There's tons and tons of shots all over the place. But the PR campaign was like all the plane stuff is real. And there's a ton of real stuff in there, but to use the word all implies that you didn't use anything else to tell the story, which is just, you know, patently not true. But I guess it gets people excited. I think it's like a part of the PR for, you know, getting people out.
It wouldn't be incorrect in Top Gun to talk about how they did a lot of it for real.
Absolutely. Tons and tons and tons of it is real. But when you just use the word like all, you're also assuming that the inverse is true, that, you know, then if it's all this, then it's none of that. But the reality is somewhere different. But it's, you know, look, we had Michael Fitzmaurice on the show to talk all about the incredible actual plane photography they did during the movie. And it's taking nothing away, but it's interesting, you know, and maybe the people who are making those claims weren't the people who really knew all of the stuff that's going into it. But yeah.
But think about hiring a VFX artist and saying, we're going to give you all these behind the scenes shots.
That's right. And now
replace
and now
the blue screen. like that was, yeah. It's not like snap your fingers and it's done. It's like someone had to sit there, at least in Adobe Premiere or Resolve or something, but probably in After Effects, maybe more, and like really precision key the stuff that was never even meant to be replaced.
I think that's part of the whole thing is like being a filmmaker is you kind of like people to see how you pulled that off. That's kind of like the spy craft. That's the trick of the trade. That's, you know, how you get some kudos from your friends and colleagues. They go, I saw what you did there. That was super cool. You know, I'm going to try that next time. And I don't know. I don't know exactly what the benefit is for changing that in Barbie, but yeah, someone was precious about it, I guess. So,
so weird. Anyway, so what is your pet obsession of the week?
It's going to come off narcissistic. I was on a podcast. I was on somebody else's podcast.
Wait,
you've
what?
Been on other people's podcast, you know,
never. I never
several times other. You've talked about it. So I was on a podcast. It's already been a month. Last month, I was on a podcast called Creative Income with Lars Lindstrom. It's a great podcast. Lars is a client of Hot Rod. He approached me and said, hey, how would you like to come talk on my podcast? And I wasn't exactly sure like what we were going to get into. And it's a lot about me. So look, if you can't get enough Ilya in your life and you want some more of me, you can certainly go over to the Lars Lindstrom Creative Income podcast and you can certainly get another like hour of me. I think at some point he's going to release a YouTube version as well. But yeah, it was a really good conversation. I don't think there's almost any editing in it at all either. It's like he put the whole thing together really well. No, he did a great job. It's a really great conversation. And I really actually enjoyed going on someone else's show where I wasn't the one asking all the questions, where someone else was asking me the questions.
Yeah, and that was on the other foot.
It was pretty fun, I got to say. So if you're not familiar with the Creative Income podcast, you can find it on Apple and Spotify and all the places that you get your podcasts. So, but if you go to the, not even the most recent one, but the second to most recent one, yours truly is on the show. And it was a lot of fun. And I hope that people will go from our podcast and go subscribe and listen to Lars Lindstrom.
I mean, I'll check it out just so I can mock you. So,
oh, yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. He's got other really good people on the show. And it's mostly people talking about their career in the industry and basically how they're somehow able to make a living, how they're able to turn creativity or creative, you know, ostensibly creative work into income that supports them and their family and what it is that they do. And so there's sort of a financial economic hybrid of creativity and technology that all kind of comes together in a show. So, and he's got directors and producers and actors and, you know, people who own camera shops and do podcasts like me on there. So,
very cool. Very, very cool. I will check it out.
All right, Ben, that's going to do it for this week. Who do we have to thank?
I want to thank Kay Zalatracci, who gave up most of his last Friday to help me get my computer working again. I drove my computer out to his place, and he's a brilliant tinkerer and knows so much more about how a computer is set up than anyone should. But Kay's, if you haven't heard every episode of this up until now, Kay's provided 100% of the music that we have in the show. And he also has, like, if you go to his studio now, he has all these racks of old-timey synths that he's messing around with and rewiring and tinkering with again. Like I got to give it up to a tinkerer, because I'm not one. I know you are one. And I admire the spirit of, like, I'm going to tear open this machine and see why it does what it does. We should also obviously thank Alana Cody, who is kicking all the ass. I mean, I can't stress enough what a heroic job she did getting us through Oscar season. We interviewed 4 of the 5 Oscar nominated DPs, and that's all her.
You know, actually what Alana Cody does that I don't think most of our listeners realize is that she enables us to quite often be able to turn off our brains. We can, because of her, she will send us like an email or a message and she'll say like, must watch this, interview this date. And so I know sometimes that my viewing schedule is going to be completely dictated by Alana. Alana's going to say, watch this, 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 and this. And then we're going, then you're going to interview this person, this person, this person, or this person. So it's like, hey, on Tuesday night, I know exactly what I'm watching. So. anyway, yeah.
And then last but never least, and I feel like I owe him 100 apologies, Ben Katz, our editor. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. I feel a little bit under the weather. It's not COVID. Just took a COVID test. Not COVID.
Phew.
Whew. I don't know. I don't know if I could have COVID because I just had COVID a couple months ago. Anyway, I hope I haven't made it too difficult on Ben today, but Ben is an awesome editor and an invaluable member of our crew here. Ilya, where can people find you?
Well, I guess you can find me over at the Creative Income podcast this week, you can find me the rest of the time over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Also, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I've got an inbox of stuff there I have to reply to and all the usual stuff. I'm one of the only Ilya Friedmans in the world. Certainly seems to be the only one with 2 L's in Ilya. So pretty easy to track down if you want to reach out to me and talk to me about building a studio or gear or podcasting or any of that stuff. All Ben, right. Where can people find you?
You can go right to benrock.com and you can find all my social media connections and watch my reel, read the bio that I wrote for myself. I hate doing stuff like that. You can mock it. You can go on social media and tell me that it sucks. But that's where to find me. So, Ilya, are you ready to sign us off?
Until next time. How was that? cheesy enough. Until next time. This has been the Cinematography Podcast.
I'm going to let it go. I think that all was
right.
Good.
All right. Cool. All right. Until next time. All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.